Hi, I'm Jillian Caldwell-Clark, and you're listening to the fourth and final episode of Bespoke, a project and podcast created by me about the media and how it works. One thing I continually go back to when looking at our media landscape and the power that media can hold sometimes is the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing and its perpetrator, a young man who is one of the most straightforward examples we have of what happens when harmful rhetoric is spoon-fed to an individual ready to be radicalized. On April 19th, 1995, a homemade bomb destroyed the Alfred P. Murrah building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people. White supremacist and right-wing extremist Timothy McVeigh was responsible, with help from fellow extremist Terry Nichols and probably a few others. McVeigh was a small-town kid from upstate New York whose father and grandfather had worked in the same plant for most of their lives. By the time he was ready to work, the plant was a fraction of what it once was. He could never quite stick to a job and eventually join the military. As his fascination with guns grew, he slowly became indoctrinated into radical white supremacists and anti-government groups while working at gun shows in his area. In McVeigh's letters to friends and family, he would recommend the right-wing media he consumed in passionate prose. And when he was arrested for the bombing, one of the first books he asked for in jail was by none other than Rush Limbaugh. In Homegrown, Jeffrey Toobin's recent book on McVeigh and the bombing, Toobin writes that McVeigh failed to find his army because he had no efficient way to locate and mobilize potential allies. In other words, McVeigh did not have the internet, in particular social media. As it turned out, there was an army of McVeigh heirs out there, but it took the invention of cyberspace for the soldiers to find one another. I don't use the Oklahoma City bombing as an example lightly, or with the intention of implying that this is the future for all young white men consuming the current stream of right-wing or right-leaning media available to them. I simply use it as an example of the worst that can happen if we continue down this path. There was a lot that went into making Timothy McVeigh who he was, and media is not the only predictor here, but it also didn't help. The landscape we have now is more efficient than ever at getting harmful ideas and information in front of young people without many barriers in between. We have other more recent examples of what happens when frustrated people are caught up in the misinformation and negative messaging they are spoon-fed by the media and media platforms that they inhabit. Professor DiResta has a lot of stories in her book about when these things go from online to offline disputes. But I'll focus particularly on Dr. Peter Hotez, who shared a Vice magazine article criticizing popular podcaster Joe Rogan for hosting Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on June 17th, 2023. The professor of pediatrics and molecular virology, I don't know if I said that right, but I gave it a good try, posted the Vice article, which chronicled Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s usual laundry list of weird beliefs, theories about 5G and Wi-Fi making people sick, and fear-mongering about vaccines being top of that list. Dr. Hotez had been on Rogan's podcast before to dispel myths around vaccines at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. When he posted the article with his critique, Joe Rogan replied in a Twitter post, which offered him the opportunity to debate RFK Jr. on his show. Rogan said, "I am offering you $100,000 to the charity of your choice if you're willing to debate him on my show with no time limit." RFK Jr. was all game for this, and it started a debate around whether debating people who did not use scientific fact was helpful or harmful. Ultimately, Dr. Hotez decided not to go on Rogan's show, saying that he would go on one-on-one, but not with RFK Jr. and not for a debate. And now I'll read a longer passage from DiResta's book on what happened after that. She writes, "The interaction trended, leading to a deluge of comments and replies. Many were extremely nasty. other prominent COVID vaccine opponents got in the game, offering their own money to enrich the pot and drawing their factions into the conversation. Potez, who has 460,000 followers, generally maintains a positive tone in his posts. He is not a culture warrior, though he does have a long-standing collection of anti-vaccine reply guys whose commentary he occasionally highlights to his own audience. Potez is influential and not exempt from critique. His expertise informs public health policies, and he has developed several vaccines in use globally. He is also clearly a public figure. He is regularly on television and podcasts, has written books, and testified in front of Congress. He is capable of holding his own in response to public criticism, and he good-naturedly did so during the barrage. Mainstream media outlets sympathetically covered his effort. But many of the online brawlers were not interested in actual debate. Much of the mob's barrage consisted primarily of personal attacks and smears. And on June 18th at 10:50 a.m., Potez tweeted that two people had showed up at his door, filming him as he stood outside. They posted the video online. It had taken just over 24 hours from the first interaction on Twitter to a pair of individuals showing up on his front stoop. Apparently, Rogan, Musk, and RFK Jr. had nothing to say about that. Now, luckily, these individuals were not violent, but we have seen cases where others are. And I personally believe that if you're going to start something like this, you should take responsibility for the real-life outcomes that affect people's lives. However, despite making millions of dollars every year off of an audience that sees you as a friend and enjoys the cozy atmosphere of your podcast, people aren't willing to take responsibility when their audience actually listens to what they say. And while I don't believe that most people will resort to acts of political violence or terrorism, we are already seeing that that does not have to be the case for harm to be done to communities across the country. Weaponized rhetoric turns into actual violence when it goes unchecked. We are in a particular moment in history when weaponized rhetoric is in front of us every day. And we saw the power of that rhetoric take form in the election of President Donald Trump, whose rhetoric already resulted in one violent insurrection against the United States. I also know someone right now is making the point that a vote for Donald Trump is not necessarily a step towards extremist radicalization. And for most people, sure, I agree, it doesn't. For most people, a vote in today's broken system is just a choice between two candidates they've heard a lot of bad stuff about. And because of this, I invite us all to take a step back and consider nuance for a second. In one episode previously, I said that media can usually not just infiltrate a population with no outside help. There is no hypodermic needle, and we do not just receive messaging in a vacuum. Our surroundings and the information we gather in our everyday lives informs how we receive messaging and information given to us by the media. However, just because not everyone who voted for Trump is a right-wing extremist, that doesn't take away from the fact they did vote for a leader that is now doing an insurmountable amount of harm. And that's bad, in my book. So now I am going to outline what I mean when I say dangerous and weaponized rhetoric. And as an example, I am going to start with a piece of the puzzle that I have not touched on enough as we talk about who is attracted to the likes of right-wing rhetoric and Donald Trump: white supremacists. White supremacists love Donald Trump. And yes, whether or not President Trump himself is a white supremacist is something that can be debated. I have my own opinions and won't be speaking so much to that right now. Either way, I will say that his rhetoric has always relied on talking points white supremacists seem to love. There is a wealth of hard evidence that white supremacists, organized groups in this country who hold white supremacy as a core pillar of their beliefs, love and support Donald Trump. They've been super vocal about it. On election night of 2016, Andrew Anglin, the founder of neo-Nazi website Daily Stormer, said, "We're with him every step of the way," in reference to President Trump. Former Grand Wizard of the KKK, David Duke, endorsed Trump and encouraged the audience of his radio show to go vote for him. On his second inauguration day in January of 2025, flyers began popping up in communities in Kentucky, reusing his rhetoric against migrants while also advertising for local KKK chapters. As Professor Jennifer Murcia notes in her book, Demagogue for President, this is an area where Trump uses one of his well-worn rhetorical tools. In this case, saying something without actually saying it, or paralipsis, God, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, to avoid directly endorsing or disavowing these characters completely. For instance, when asked about Duke's endorsement, Trump answered, "I don't need his endorsement. I certainly don't want his endorsement. I don't need anyone's endorsement." In that same interview, when asked why he thinks white supremacists liked him, he responded that, "A lot of people like me. Republicans like me. Liberals like me. Everybody likes me." This interview provides us with an example of one of the rhetorical tools Marcia says he uses incredibly well. She writes that Trump's use of paralipsis also gives plausible deniability for Americans who wanted to support his campaign but didn't see themselves as racists. This is an example of weaponized rhetoric. Rhetoric, in its purest form, Marcia writes, is a meeting of minds that invites people to change their opinions. The power of weaponized rhetoric is that it, to quote Professor Marcia again, thank you so much, appears to be rhetoric. It appears to be a method of deliberation with a goal of democratic decision-making, but it in fact undermines both democratic decision-making and democracy itself. Murcia outlines five other rhetorical tools President Trump uses in his messaging, three meant to bring people together and three meant to divide. The first three are meant to bring his base together. The first is an appeal to the crowd, the second an appeal to American exceptionalism, and the third was mentioned before and is the I'm not saying, I'm just saying approach, aka paraplegics. The second three are meant to divide us. There's attacking the person instead of the idea, threats of force or intimidation, and the objectification of his opponents. And yes, there are some fun, fancy Latin words that describe all of those, but I just use simple English to get to the point. Later in her work, Marcia points out that these rhetorical tools are only useful in the right conditions. She writes that in 2016, we were alienated, distrusting, polarized, and frustrated. And I guess in 2024, we were also all of those things, maybe even more so than in 2016. The American people were primed and ready to receive the weaponized rhetoric of Trump and his administration. The youngest Trump voter was 8 years old when Trump first ran for president. They grew up in this environment. This is no longer a glitch. This is an undeniable part of American culture. And it's a part that we all have to face and recognize that we've probably internalized at least a little bit of it in the past decade. So the next step is asking, is there a way to get through this with a semi-intact democracy? In her new book, Stories Are Weapons, Psychological Warfare and the American Mind, Annalee Newitz speaks with Ruth Emrys Borden, a researcher and professor on misinformation at the University of Maryland, as well as a science fiction author. And Borden says this. She says, "I could not think of a way to have a good future with the internet as it exists today. I like the internet. I like the telepathic feed. But I don't see how that's compatible with societal relationships we need. So I wrote about an internet that has been broken into smaller networks with stronger protections between them to slow down discourse a bit and provide incentives for people to think about the value and accuracy of what they're sharing." Newitz speaks to several other experts who also contemplate what a slower internet and slower media system would look like. The dream here is that we take away the instant gratification that something like Twitter or X gives us and make people wait to see responses or for their posts to be posted. And while I love that idea, it would take so long to get us all to a place where we would be cool with that. And I love the idea, and if it happens someday, that would be great. Renee DiResta ends her book with several suggestions for a way forward. Her recommendations come down to content moderation, regulation and education. Of course, when people hear content moderation, their first concern is the possible infringements on their First Amendment rights. And I'll admit to having a little bit of an ick the first time I just read the phrase content moderation. In fact, that discomfort has been used several times by right-wing leaders and influencers to undermine the efforts of those trying to find solutions to misinformation and harmful rhetoric. During the height of the pandemic, certain influencers made a particular stink over their content being labeled by social media sites for their questionable facts and sources. And of course, the thing that DiResta points out, and that I will also now point out, is that just because people have the right to speak, that does not mean that the privately owned companies do not have the right to moderate and limit amplification through the algorithm. DiResta also points out that while people might want certain platforms and sites to be a public square of sorts, people in actual public squares usually follow more social norms and display more empathy than those in online settings. Regulation is another option that would be great if people in power could actually pull such a feat off. I have my doubt that any helpful legislation could be passed right now, though. So, in my opinion, for regular people and communities without an excess of resources, the best option is education, which of course still takes a good amount of resources. However, as I said before, there are a lot of good people working for solutions right now, and a good amount of free information from these people, experts and academics, on media literacy. One place to start would be the National Association for Media Literacy. It was founded in 1997 and has been working, and I'm getting this from their website now, to make media literacy highly valued and widely practiced as an essential life skill. They have a ton of free resources and networks you can look into, so please check them out. And if you do have the resources to donate or support a cause, I would also recommend looking into your local independent newsrooms and public media. I've talked a lot about the systems built around the media, but there are excellent professionals within that system trying their best under very difficult circumstances. If we invest in the spaces they need to thrive and speak truth to power, it will only be to our benefit. Okay, and with that, I will leave you. I hope you enjoyed listening, or at the very least, learned something. I'm going to have all my sources listed in the description, but I do want to say thank you so much to the actual researchers and historians and academics for their work. I hope I pronounced all of your names correctly, although I really doubt it. Anyway, I'm Jillian Caldwell-Clark. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you soon.